Welcome to La Taverna Friuli Wines, the definitive podcast on wines from Friuli Venezia Giulia. I'm your host, Wayne Young. Hey, Friuli wine fans, this is Wayne Young, La Taverna Friuli Wines. Got an English episode for you today. My guest is Brian Larkey, old-time friend, wine slinger, as they say. Dalaterra is the name of the company that Brian runs out of California, dealing exclusively with Italian wines, and I wanted to talk about Friulian wines with my friend Brian. Lots of interesting things here in this interview with Brian, so I'm going to get right to it. Let's get right to this great conversation with Brian Larkey from Dalaterra.
You might hear me drop out every once in a while, as if you can't tell by my voice, I'm dealing with a cold. I'm on the tail end of it. So, but yeah, it's my voice is, I don't know how long it's going to last. And every once in a while I need to cough. So I'm going to like hit the mute button. And then this way you don't have to hear me hacking into the microphone. But Brian Larkey, thank you for being here on La Taverna. We've known each other for a long, long time, a really long time. I think we probably met when I was still working at Becco, like back in 1997. Is that possible?
Assolutamente.
You came in selling. Do you still pound the pavement? Are you still out there like going and making calls on accounts, or is that the more part of your past?
The pavement is the pulse of the market.
Nice.
So yeah, if you disconnect yourself from that, if you're too good, too slow, too tired, too weak to get out there into the market and meet people, meet the new folks, congratulate the folks who've been around, say thank yous, do introductions, you probably shouldn't be out there. I mean, it's where I get ideas and inspiration and learn hands-on first place what's happening and where the numbers begin to make sense. The numbers, as we're looking at statistics and analysis and all that, what is this? Why is this? What's happening here? And then you get down into the trenches and
maybe you get some answers.
That's where it all begins to be clear. As I say, you know, the wine business is whatever that quote is. It's some beautiful, wonderful business where rich men go to die like dogs or whatever. It's kind of depressing, but there's a lot of truth in there because I think the wine biz is one of the most competitive businesses in the world.
It is. And it's only becoming more competitive as time goes on.
Indeed. I mean, there's a lot of constriction. There's a lot of consolidation happening, a lot of homogenization happening.
Unfortunately.
And at the same time, there's a lot, it gets more and more complex as new things begin to grow and build. And it's a constant challenge. And for those who appreciate a good challenge, it's a wonderful industry to be in. I'll say that.
Yeah, I can't complain. So the name of your company is Dalaterra, and when did you start up? How did you sort of get your start in that and that whole thing? Whose big fat idea was it to start importing wines?
Oh man, Dalaterra means of the earth, Dalaterra, like terra firma. And the idea was born in Italy. And so I focus on Italy. I focus on Italian wines. It was born in Italy between like 85 and 90.
Oh, wow.
And those long years time. That I was working. Yeah, I studied going back to the beginning. I studied enology and biochemistry at UC Davis, which is a great school for wine and viticulture. And so I did that from 85 to 90. At the same time, I was working a lot in the Napa Valley. So every harvest would take, you know, August, September, October off from university and go work in the Napa Valley. And at the time, it was fascinating. And it really opened my eyes up to that integration of man and nature. And a little bit of the Davis approach at the time was kind of controlling or manipulating or guiding nature. And now things have shifted quite a bit to almost taking a backseat and highlighting the differences in what nature has to offer us. But back in the day, it was a wonderful learning ground. Davis is to this day, you know, obviously one of the leading universities. And it gave me a lot of insight, not just into the science of it, but the people of it. And then we had a lot of students that came from abroad. And so a lot of the students there, especially in grad school and stuff, were coming from overseas. They were coming from Europe. They're coming from South Africa. They're coming from Eurasia, coming over from Australia and stuff. And it was really, really interesting. And that's what really opened my eyes up to wine in general, to the world of wine in particular. And it gave me an opportunity to get some hands-on experience, because it's only about an hour drive from Davis over to, you know, Napa Sonoma area. And so a lot of us took advantage of that and secured positions and started working and all that. And so after all that wrapped up for me and I got my degree in 85, I had a job lined up in Italy.
Oh, okay. And so I was wondering what the Italian connection was.
That was it. So,
where did you go to work in Italy?
I got a phone call from Maurizio Zanella, who founded Cado Bosco in Erbusco, in French.
Okay.
He was looking for specifically an American, specifically a UC Davis graduate, because he wanted to bring in kind of that perspective. And at the time, he had Monsieur Andre Dubois, who's a chef de cave at Dom Perignon and retired from DP and was over at Cado Bosco for many, many years, guiding the sparkling wine production over there. And so he had that background. He kind of wanted to combine that with what was coming up, what was on the avant-garde, what was Davis doing. And so he reached out to some friends of his in the United States and the university directly. And they said, you know, Brian, he's crazy enough. He'd go to Italy. And so I got the phone call and I jumped on that opportunity. Because when you think back to it, Wayne, back in 85, Italy hadn't really come into its own yet in terms of the international market.
Yeah, I think that really started to gel like late 80s, like 89, 90. I think Jeremy Parzon always talks about like that 89, 90 transition when Italian wine became cool.
I think Jeremy's right on the numbers in terms of that. And before that, you may have met an old dear friend who's now passed away, Philip DeBellardino, and he worked in the wine biz years and years. And Philip always talked about that transition of Italy going from red and white checker cloth tables to and spaghetti to kind of pasta, a complex carbohydrate, and how Italy kind of made this leap in the restaurants. And you know, from working at Becco and other spots, how that kind of grew and became the darlings of the food scene in America.
Yeah.
And the same thing kind of began to happen a little bit more slowly in the wine biz. And I would say when I went out there in 1985, that's when, I mean, Cado Bosco was coming onto the scene. People were proud of being Italian and proud of Italian wines. We had more and more Italian restaurants that were kind of leading the charge. I think having that tie-in with food and wine and culture is really what it's all about. And having that strong Italian restaurant base to drive some of these wines forward was key. And then another thing that was happening, for better or for worse, and we could dig into this if you want, and just to kind of see how the pendulum swings.
Okay.
And that is the gravitational force of what Napa Valley was doing in the wine world in the United States. Everyone wanted to be Napa. Italians coming into the marketplace were looking at Napa Cab and Napa Chardonnay. And we found a lot of new vineyards being planted in Italy to mirror what was happening in Napa Valley. And so we saw more Chardonnay, not just Chardonnay, but we saw more barrel fermented Batonnage wines coming out. We saw more Cab. We saw more Cab being blended in with Sangiovese, and the super Tuscan craze took off in, I guess, I don't know, the mid 80s or something like that. And all these things were happening at the time that I, you know, first moved on out there. And so it was a bit of a, it was almost like a black hole kind of caving in on itself, this huge gravitational force.
Okay.
So it was the market just kind of pulling people into these international varietals.
Yeah, that was, that's sort of all tied into like also that Parkerization, that Parker era, you know, styles of wines that, you know.
What kind of wines were being lauded? What kind of wines were being celebrated?
Exactly.
Who was getting these big scores, right?
Big fruit bombs, lots of oak, you know, super rich, yeah, dense wines.
Right. And at Cava Bosco, where we had both Cab, Pinot Noir, and Chardonnay at pretty high levels, the thinking at the time, 40 years ago, was we need to show that we can do this on their terms. We know that we need to show that we can make these kind of wines that can compete on an international stage. And then after we've kind of proven ourselves to the world, we can go ahead and start doing some other local things.
That's exactly the same story that I remember Sergio Esposito telling me. I think it was like a Tre Bicchieri tasting or something like that. Yeah. And he said that, you know, there was a time when everybody was saying, you know, the international varieties are the way that Italy is going to, you know, penetrate the world market. So everybody started, you know, grubbing up all of the native varieties and started planting Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc and Merlot and Cabernet. And then like not even like 5 or 6 years later, right? Even though there was some huge success with those international varieties, they completely backtracked and they were like, well, now that we're making progress with this, we must return to the native varieties. And there were all these producers like pulling their hair out of their head because they had just like grubbed all that stuff up. So yeah, that's exactly mirrors what I remember him saying. So now there is a really big return to the native varieties.
Yeah, I liken this to a pendulum, and it swung one way, and now it's gaining force as it's swinging back down. I think we've gone past kind of that up and down, and now we're swinging back out to the other side, which is diversity, which is let's get back to where each of these individual areas are. How do we shine? Do we shine as a group, or do we shine? You know, do we shine as Italy as a whole? Do we shine as Northeast Italy? Do we shine as Friuli Veneto? Do we shine just as Friuli? Do we shine as Colli Orientali, Carso? All these different regions as we begin to dive down into them. And I think that the lean right now, and in my opinion, rightfully so, is all about differentiating yourself and differentiating your region, your wines, and going back to the origins. And I mean, I don't know what number I know you do a lot of education, a lot of teaching, and a lot of proselytizing out there, Wayne, specifically for the wines of Friuli. But when you're out there teaching, I don't know how many varietals you talk about. I'll just pick 600 as a number. But Italy's really one of the most diverse wine growing regions in the world. It just is. I mean, I'm calling you right now from the heart of Napa Valley. Dolaterra has been based in Napa since the inception, and we're surrounded by 6 varietals, maybe 7 on a good day, right? But not 600.
Yeah, for sure.
And Italy is so fun and so exciting and so chaotic. It's kind of like, you know, you watch the roundabouts in Rome and you see how these people are driving and they're all coming in from different angles and there's no real lanes and they're just kind of finding their own way.
And there's a beautiful chaos.
It is. And even from a distance, it's kind of fun. But you get inside of that stuff and it's kind of scary. And then it's like, well, where are we going to park? Oh, we'll just park here. Well, you can't really park. Oh, yeah. No, va bene. Va bene. I'm not going to qui. It's like, okay. Ma dove con me? Vai avanti. Gira destra. E poi il ristorante là davanti. But I can't go right at that corner because there's a one-way sign. And the guy pushes the car.
Just go. Just go.
Ma Brian, ma vuoi andare o no? Like, you want to get there or not? It's like, just go.
Yeah.
And
so
that was a little bit of what was happening in the wine industry as a whole. As it, I wouldn't say it devolved. I would say it expanded and it evolved back into the beautiful diversity that is already inherent in Italian viticulture.
Right.
And, you know, Italy's not a country. Italy is like this tapestry of these little pieces that have been stitched together since way before Mussolini's time.
Oh,
and
boy.
It doesn't necessarily hold together that well. You know, everything's kind of stretched and pulled. And it's not like in the States where you got reds and blue states, it's way more complex than that. Yeah. You've got dialect, languages, and cultures, and you have to look at the bleed over from all the different cultures, you know, from the Arabic culture that's been going back and forth into Sicily, and the Spanish culture that's come across, and the Austrian and the Germanic cultures to the north, and then, you know, obviously where we're sitting right now and with our hearts in Friuli, you know, everything that's happened out in that area from the Austro-Hungarian Empire,
yep,
to the Turks, to everything. I mean, it's just, Italy is not Italy. Italy is this beautiful tapestry of dialects and foods.
And I don't think a lot of people realize that. People who haven't spent more than a week here visiting Venice, Rome, and Florence understand how really it was such a fragmented society before that, and it still exists in certain things. I mean, you know, the dialect will change. It's 22 kilometers from Udine to Cividale, and basically, you know, there's a dialect change from there. Udine has its own dialect, which is completely different from Friulano. So it's so different. Everything changes so quickly, and there's so much identity to where you are, the actual little village where you come from. There's a lot of pride in that type of identifying with a very, very specific place and with very, very specific grape varieties as well. You know, everybody's really proud of their Rifosco. Everybody's really proud of their Friulano or whatever you may be growing at that time. But, you know, on the other hand, for consumers, especially I think with Friulian wines, when you have producers who are producing 12 or 13 or 14 different bottlings, that can become a little bit intimidating. It can become a little bit, you're losing your focus. I mean, sometimes I wonder, do we make too much wine here in Friuli?
Do we make too much wine? Or do we
too
make
many too different many kinds?
Different, we make too many kinds of wine.
Too many kinds of wine, yeah.
I think that there's a lot of good analogies for that. So let me just hit pause here for a second and go back to describe more who I am and what I do. We didn't really get to that at the beginning.
No, we didn't. We didn't. So jump back to that.
Maybe you can just cut and paste this up to the beginning of it.
For sure.
Just fade in and out with it. But I founded a company called Dalla Terra, which we mentioned earlier, which is means of the earth, Dalla Terra. And Dalla Terra is 100% Italian-focused wine and spirits importer, marketer, representative, and ambassador of Italian wines and spirits in the United States. So we coordinate the United States market for a number of families, Italian families. We work with exclusively with Italian products from the north to the south, from Alto Adige to Sicily, from Piedmont to Colio, from the whole length and the breadth of Italy. And
gotcha. How many wineries do you represent?
Oh, so it's, some wineries, like in Friuli, we work with both Marco Fluga and Ricci Superiore. It kind of folds up into a single family.
Okay. No, but I'm talking about in Italy total.
Yeah. In Italy, I mean, we've got over, I don't know, probably close to 30 or something like that, including, it depends on how it gets counted, including some of the new spirits producers that we're working with. Italy has an incredible history of spirits. And so we've been delving into that for the last 2 years as well.
Cool.
And expanding on our wine base. But my background goes back to winemaking. My background goes back to working in the Napa Valley, graduating from Davis with a degree in enology and vit, and then moving to Italy and working for 5 years for Canabosco, as taking over production in Canabosco when the previous winemaker went back to Champagne. That was Michelin de Dubois. So I got to work with him. And then moved on from there. And then in 1990, came back to the States and founded Dalla Terra and began to bring Italian wines into the United States with a very different model. How do we set Friulian wines aside? That's a question, or apart. That's a question we'll get into. And how is I able to set Dalla Terra apart? And Dalla Terra is, we work basically on a commission. So, we charge a percentage, and we believe that we give tremendous value to what we do. So the producers are able to have higher margins with us, and the consumer pays less because we don't just buy things, mark them up, and sell them and resell them for additional markups.
That's a very unique business plan.
Yeah, it's a much more efficient system. And I think we're the only folks in the U.S. for Taiwans that are doing this. We've got a whole description on our website, dollarterra.com, so people can look at that and really begin to understand the implications of that, which is, it's pretty fascinating. And we're really, I guess, because I started in the cellars, that I've always been winery-centric.
Right.
And so I was always looking at, like, you know, what's best for the producers here? How are we going to make this work? And as a result, after 33 plus years, we still have a lot of the
So just to be clear, the typical importer, for example, would contact a winery, be interested in their wines, buy their wines for a price, bring them over, pay all the duties and the shipping and everything to get them to the United States, and then mark them up to make a profit and then sell that either to a distributor or if they have that ability to distribute, to sell them directly to the public. So one of the things that we always complain about in the United States is that three-tier system, right? Importer, distributor, and then retailer, which everybody takes more or less a 50% markup off of that. So a $10 bottle of wine here in Italy costs $45 in the States, for example. But so you're basically, you bring in these wines and basically you sell them for a price and you just take a commission off of what you're selling it for. You're not marking it up 50%.
Exactly. Okay.
So and are you distributing as well? So you, because you came to me, I was buying wine from you. No. So you also distribute.
We're not a distributor.
Okay.
So we coordinate the U.S. market. And so in many cases, you need, well, think of the U.S. as 50 different countries and each one has its own licensing. And so it's complex. It's expensive to do business in the U.S.
Yeah.
Because as you mentioned, Wayne, you've got a three-tier system. And in many cases, you're prohibited by law to go, you know, work across all the different tiers.
Like
so
New York,
bring it in, to import it, to self-distribute it, and then to sell it out of your own wine shop kind of thing, direct, or selling it out of your warehouse, DTC, direct to consumer. Some cases you can, many you cannot. There's just, it's a whole plethora of complexities that go into that. And so what we do is we eliminate the national importers. So the ones that bring stuff in, mark it up and resell it. And instead, we work completely in concert with the producers. We are completely 100% aligned with the producers so that when the producer is making more money, Dollarterra makes more money. And so we want to be able to maximize their efforts in the U.S. market.
Gotcha.
But at the same time, we say, hey, you know, let's rein this in. Here's the key price point. This is the sweet spot where we need to be. That allow us to maintain these prices for years so that we don't want to have changes in the market and we want to be able to continue to grow and invest. And the wineries will listen to us because it's the best thing for both of us in the long run, as opposed to a national importer that may, on occasion, kind of push down the pricing as much as they can and then raise the resale price as much as they can because they make their margin is on that delta, right? On the difference between what they pay for it and what they sell it for with us. It's all one number, you know, it's all going to get sold at whatever price we determine in concert with our producers. And we make a percentage of that.
Okay.
So it's a really synergistic way of working. It's actually a really beautiful and sustainable way of working because we can make long-term plans together. It's a really, really clever way. And at the same time, it's really hard for anyone to go ahead and begin to do that because we work on lower margins on purpose than, you know, most any national importer does. And so given we just talked about the formula and there's more information on our website, but to try and go ahead and do that today, even with a recipe, it's like, can you bake the cake? And the market has changed so much that to begin from scratch these days is really difficult. And it's not that it's a secret. It's more like I'm a little saddened by the fact that there are not a lot of people doing this, because I think it would benefit more producers and benefit more American consumers if people were able to figure this out and make it work. But it's kind of like getting fission to work. You need a certain critical mass to take off.
Okay.
You need a big enough portfolio and you need that with a large enough distribution base in the U.S. And that's really the critical issue. I think when we come back around the circle to Friuli, it all comes down to, If we love Friuli and we love the various regions within Friuli, we want to teach it, we want to talk about it. How do we do that? And in this country, we can't do anything until we get it into the United States, right? It's got to come across the pond.
Right.
It's got to get in the country. And so by definition, we've got to work with the various importers, which in this country are often our distributors are also individual importers into their individual markets. But there's a gatekeeper, right? There's someone there with their hands on the valve, opening and closing this valve. And it ain't the producer and it ain't the person that just got back from this incredible, you know, week at La Subida and these dinners and staying over there and they're in love with the region. They want to come back and they want to go out and start this. It really is somebody else that's controlling what's available in the U.S. And so we can talk a bit more about that and then education and kind of introduction to the U.S. market for what Fruly has to offer, which is a lot.
Right.
But I think a lot of it is out of most people's hands. It's kind of out of the winery's hands to a certain extent. And there's few like-minded individuals in the U.S. that are focusing on this.
Okay. So if I'm understanding you correctly, you know, what you're saying is there's not a whole lot the producers can do, that Friulian producers can do to sort of, I don't know, raise the level of awareness of these wines, because, you know, there are maybe some preconceived notions about Friuli for the people who really are the ones who kind of are the movers and shakers in the United States market, that they don't believe as much as maybe the producers believe. So it's hard to get them enthusiastic and on board and pushing wines from Friuli. Is that kind of what you're saying?
I think that producers and wine lovers, we can do a lot, and wine writers can do a lot.
Are wine writers really still that relevant?
It depends on what they're writing about, but it depends. People are thirsty. People are hungry for knowledge, for diversity, for trying something besides what's constantly put in front of them. And I think that there's a lot that can be done. I think that there's a lot that is being done. And I think that it pales in comparison to this giant, you know, this giant river that's kind of moving on down the line, and we're little salmon kind of swimming upstream in that world. And there is a lot that we can do. There's a lot that we are doing, but I think part of it is understanding, you know, who's writing the checks. So, you know, you fall in love with this great Friulano wine, and you've got this cool Pico Leat, and you want to try this, you know, this Sauvignon from the hills. And it's like, how do I do that? I want to write a check. I want to buy something. I want to spend money.
Right.
If you're looking at buying a few bottles when you do that, or trying something new on a wine list, which is incredible. We need more ambassadors like, you know, Bobby over at Frosca and stuff like that.
Right.
But at the same time, the ones that are writing the big checks are the importers. And okay. So they're the ones that get to decide what they bring in. And so it's a matter of convincing, winning, encouraging, supporting, educating the consumers so that when these guys write the big checks to bring, you know, 1,000 cases over to the U.S., they'll do that once. They might do it twice, but there needs to be a flow of business. It needs
to be, obviously, you know, you got to make money, right? That's kind of the name of the game. I mean, nobody's in it to lose money.
There has to be a reason why you're doing this. And so I think that's one of the big challenges that we have. It's kind of like, if you want to penetrate the market, you better do it with a really sharp spear. You know, the tip of your point's got to be sharp. And to be sharp, you can't go with a blunt tip with, you know, 10 different wines trying to get in the marketplace. You got to be focused. You got to be tight. You got to drive things in. And you're never going to get an importer to buy 10 different wines to tell the full story of a given estate. You know, they're going to buy a few of the key driver wines.
So that kind of ties in with what I was saying about like too many wines, right? Because you know, the place, like, everybody makes the freaking comparison with Burgundy, right? Burgundy's got Chardonnay and it's got Pinot Noir. That's it. Whereas Friuli, we have amazing Friulano, but we also have amazing Ribolla Gialla, and we have amazing Malvasia, and then we have really cool blends, and then we have reds like Rifosco and Merlot, which is really good. So what we need to find that point of the spear, which you're talking about.
And all these incredible things.
And they're all great. I mean, that's maybe the problem. I don't know.
you know, there's two sides to that sword. It's not boring. It's exciting. It's diverse. And we're playing a game of telephone where you tell someone, they tell somebody else, they tell somebody else, and you try and keep the message the same. As it leaves, the little producer comes all the way across the Atlantic, goes in through an importer, goes from there to another distributor, goes from there on the way down to, you know, the individual salespeople, into the retailers, into the restaurants. I mean, there's a whole game of telephone here, and a lot is lost in this translation. A lot is lost along the way. So we want to keep things sharp. And then along the way, we'll find the Frothkas of the world that are, you know, keen and focused and curious and eager to share, eager to be educators, eager to be ambassadors in their areas. And that is really, really important, because that's the way we get out of this, you know, the main channel of the river and get into the, some of the side currents and the side areas. And
so what do you mean by the main? Yeah, this river euphemism, clear that up a little bit for me. I'm not really clear on what you mean by that.
The river is, we've got this giant, remember in Ghostbusters when they kind of looked down in the sewer system and they saw this giant stream of stuff just carrying underneath the city?
Yeah.
Well, that's Chardonnay and Pinot Grigio. That's what the giant river is. The giant river is Chardonnay and Pinot Grigio.
Okay.
And then it's, you know, it's kind of mixed in with Cabernet and Merlot and all this kind of stuff, right? That's what's going on, as opposed to the 600 varietals that we spoke about and the diversity in the individual regions.
Right.
And the incredible opportunities that Italy, more than almost any other country, offers. And
right.
So on one side, we have this incredible ability to share and grow and go down all these rabbit holes, which are fascinating, but they're all rabbit holes. And the mainstream of things, which is really what the business is, which is, you know, all these, you know, these containers marching across the Atlantic Ocean as they come over here, is about, it's about less is more. If they can bring in fewer varietals, it's easier to teach. It's easier to keep stock. It's easier to do this stuff. And the American public is relatively blasé. They're relatively, I like Pinot Grigio. And it kind of ends right there.
So I've had plenty of experience with that.
We got to open up the Pandora's box a little bit, because there are some amazing, amazing things deep inside. And if you look at Friuli, let's go back to a really cool place that I hope you visited. And it's Vivaio, nursery. It's a nursery in Friuli. It's probably the most famous nursery in the world.
Rauschedo.
And it's called Rauschedo. And so these guys, you know, way back when France was being inundated and losing their vines, and phylloxera was decimating stuff, and Rauschedo was growing. Rauschedo is about 100 years old today. That's why I think they were like 1920s or something like
okay.
that. And, you know, that's really what helped maintain. When you look at old cuttings, or the origin of old cuttings of what we'll call international varietals. So Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Merlot, Chardonnay, Sauvignon, all these kind of varietals, it was all already in Collio. It was already there. And then growers from France and elsewhere came back to Rauschedo in particular and, you know, replanted their vineyards with different rootstock at the time, and were able to replant and grow. But there's a huge history of international varietals in Collio, right? In Friuli, in Carso, in all these areas. And a lot of it goes back, in my opinion, to Rauschedo and having this patrimony of DNA in these cuttings that have been there literally for 100 years, and the expertise of folks that are able to do that there. And a lot of that is international varietals. And so in Collio, in Friuli, as in general, Collio Orientale and all these wonderful areas up and down on the hills there, we're looking at kind of the dichotomy of international varietals when we're here in the United States, as well as the local varietals. And that is, it's a bit of a mixed message, and I kind of think of Friuli being a really great, wonderful gateway wine drug region, we'll call it, for the United States, and even for Europe as a whole. And whether you're German, Austrian, British, you know, Swedish, whatever, you know, they as well think of international varietals that we just mentioned. And when they think of Italian varietals, many of them are just as confused or curious as the American public is. And so Friuli is wonderful because it offers both familiar varietals, Cab Franc, Merlot, Pinot Grigio, Chardonnay, you know, all this kind of stuff, along with all the incredible, you know, Ribolla Dallas and the different varietals that you're only going to find autochthonous in that area. And
well, so this was something that I used to work for Big Joe, when I used to work for Joe Bastianich. This was one of the things that we talked about a lot was, in the beginning, you know, the winery didn't have a Pinot Grigio. The winery didn't have a Chardonnay or anything like that. So once they started talking about, you know, penetrating the market and getting larger distribution in the United States, they were like, we got to have either like a Pinot Grigio or a Sauvignon Blanc, because those are the wines that are going to get your foot in the door. And then you can sort of spring the Tokaj Friulano on them.
You need a base. You need a foundation to grow from.
Yeah. So, you know, keeping these international varieties around is kind of like a, you know, it's kind of like a wedge to sort of get in to sort of a tight market and then open that door just a little bit so you can try and get in with your funkier stuff. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah, you definitely need a foundation. One needs a foundation in order to get into, and again, the market is really getting into an importer, getting into importer / distributor. That's what you're trying to get into. That's the objective. Because once you got your, that's the door that you really want to get your foot into. And then you have an opportunity to build and grow. And another thing that works, in my opinion, I don't know if the word is against Friulian wines, but one of the challenges, just call it a challenge.
Okay.
It's not insurmountable.
Right.
And that would be that when you look at the wines in Friuli in your backyard right now, Wayne, what percentage of those wines are varietal? You know, meaning they say, you know, Sauvignon or Friulano or, you know, Bianco on the label.
The vast majority.
What percentage of those are a blend?
Okay.
Where it has, you know, 20% of this and 30% of that. And Friuli has a higher percentage of blends than, let's say, Alto Adige.
Okay.
Alto Adige is very precise. It's just to be made like this, you know, all this kind
okay.
of, kind of, and the purity of flavors and the clarity of that particular varietal. Friuli is really wonderful. In fact, Marco Fuligo worked hard to change the law so that wineries were allowed to blend and still be DOC wines.
Okay.
And they encouraged that individual expression of the winery and their ability to do a blend in their vineyard that they felt best was the best representation of the estate. I have no problem with that. But at the same time, it's a name. It's a fantasy name that the wine has created.
There you go.
And for better or for worse, it's more difficult in this market. People can kind of remember, you know, the name of a producer, the name of a varietal, but then you start in some imaginary name and it's 20% of this and 40% of that. And it gets to be, you know, more individualistic, but at the same time, I think more difficult to sell in market. So that's one of the challenges that we find in Friuli. And the whole idea is the tip of the spear as you drive into a marketplace should be sharp, should be few. And it's the challenge is to, you know, keep wanting to add in, but we only make so many bottles of this and so many bottles of that. And I'm like, yeah, you do. But, you know, we need to be able to focus in order to get repetitive business and build up a following, a clientele. And the following is first, you know, to the producers. I think the ones that travel, the ones that come here, the ones that build relationships, the ones that can teach individually what's going on, I think are some of the biggest winners. And language is an important part of that.
Okay.
The work that you do as you're doing your education and your tasting and your teaching, it's vital. I mean, you see that every day. And you're in Italia. And in Italia, non è che capiscono tutto. They don't understand everything. They're like, really? I'm sure you're like, you know, and you're at ground zero. You're at home.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're trying to take that knowledge, that enthusiasm, that understanding, and get that out into, you know, from Boston to San Diego, from Seattle to Lauderdale. And, you know, there's a lot of area that we're trying to work to educate, to culture, to almost, you know, we gotta plant these little vines, and it takes decades.
Grow
and build.
Well, you know, when I first came here, now we're talking, you know, 22 years ago when I moved here and 25 years ago when I first arrived here.
Right.
It more than 25 years ago, you know, blends were kind of like the focus, right? Everybody had their top wine, which was a blend. It could be a red or a white or both. And that was the model, right? You had your entry-level wines, your fresh wines were all mono varietals, and then your top-tops were your blends, right? Vintage Tunina, Terre Alte, yep. That was the model, you know? Vespa Bianco fell into that category. But those wines are so hard to sell unless you have a really, really strong brand like Vintage Tunina that a lot of people have abandoned that. And now what's happening is the return of that is let's start limiting the types of blends that we can make them very, very similar across numerous producers. So, for example, Collio di Uvio Autoctone, Malvasia, Ribolla Gialla, Friulano. Those are your three grapes. There's a certain minimum, I think, of Ribolla Gialla, which I think is like minimum 50% or something, or Friulano 50%. And after that, the world's your oyster, right? You have to wait a certain amount of time. And there are a lot of people signing on to that, but the focus is not on the wine or the brand of the wine. The focus is on Collio. And I think something is afoot here also in Collio Orientale to do something along those lines. So yeah, I think blends are important, but I think they are the hardest wines to sell, especially in a market like the United States, which is so grape-centric. People want to see a grape name on the bottle. They want to know. And then if they don't recognize the grape name, they don't want to buy it because I'm like, I don't know if I like Ribolla Gialla. And then if they had a Ribolla Gialla one time and they buy another one and it's completely and utterly different from the one that they had before, they're going to say, I don't know anything about this wine. I'm just going to stick the Pinot Grigio.
Yeah. Some people love surprises. And most when you think about a market, markets don't like surprises. They don't like to be challenged. What if it's not what they, what if they spent a bunch of money in a restaurant and they didn't like it?
Right.
There's a barrier to entry. There's fear of, Venice, Nina, whatever it was. I mean, these are all, some of these are quite pricey. And so it's a challenge for people to try something they're unfamiliar with. At least you're familiar with Sauvignon or Pinot Grigio or something.
Right.
And it becomes, this is too harsh of a summary, but it's almost the dumbing down because it's too hard to stay that curious and that diverse. And yet that's what drives it. That's what's going to keep us around is that, and I started this conversation in the beginning saying, we need the diversity, saying we need these kind of things.
Right.
And that's what separates us from everybody else. And okay. I think that's really, really important to maintain that. But we have to find the people that are going to be responsive, not responsible to that.
Okay.
And receptive. That's probably a better word. That are receptive to that.
Receptive to sort of the more Nietzsche kind of stuff. The more esoteric things.
Okay, so you brought up Burgundy. So here's another comparison. Let's take Friuli versus Chianti. Okay.
Yeah.
And what they're comparing. So we talked about different styles, different varietals, and the plethora of varietals and things that are out here in Friuli. And then we get into Vini Macerati. We get into orange wines. We get into, some of the stuff that, Radica and all these guys were playing with. Decades ago, which is a whole nother conversation.
Exactly.
But it adds to the complexity and the diversity of what the region offers. And then let's shift gears. Let's go over to Tuscany. Let's go inside of Chianti. Well, there we're dealing primarily with Sangiovese, with one varietal. And the difference of what they're focusing on is the idea of Ugas, Ugachica. So they're looking at these.
What?
Ugasiche aggiuntive.
Okay.
Unità geografica aggiuntiva, the user of the 11.
I heard about these. What a horrible acronym, an UGA.
Unità geografica aggiuntiva, additional geographic.
Awful.
It's kind of what it means. But the idea is they're looking at the geography, and they're looking at this village at that altitude versus this one, that exposure at that altitude. And they've broken Chianti Classico into these 11 different districts. And it's akin to what was happening or what has happened in Burgundy and elsewhere, or even in Napa, where you're looking at Cabernet, whether it comes from Yountville or Rutherford or Calistoga. Here you're looking at a varietal, but it's being sliced and diced via these 11 UGAs.
Yeah, there's
so
always...
It's a way of looking at a region.
Yeah, well, there's always been this kind of fight here, too, in Friuli, whether or not you should be working from the top down or from the bottom up. You know, a lot of people, myself included, worked really hard to sort of create the Friuli DOC, like the Sicily DOC, to make sure that we were avoiding that Venezia Giulia IGT, which did not talk about Friuli at all. And it has been taken up by some people.
5 billion acres of land is too much, huh?
and then other people are saying, well, no, we need to like break things down to even like the finer components, AKA Burgundy. So like Butrio is one, Inciala is another, and Spezza is another, and Cormons is another, and you know, more and more broken apart. But there are pros and cons to both of those. The more we break things down, the more esoteric things become. You know, people don't understand what Butrio is. They don't even understand what Friuli is. So my attitude has always been sort of let's work from the bottom up, but I don't think it's wrong to work from the top down either.
Especially in Friuli. I mean, Tuscany Chianti, they're working primarily with one varietal, right?
Right. Yeah. So you need to differentiate in some way.
Yeah, the vast majority is all Sangiovese. And so then you're going to look at the differentiations of how Sangiovese expresses itself in this soil, that elevation, this exposure, which is a beautiful way to really understand a region.
Do you think that ties in also with the volume of wine that's made in Chianti as well? That you're sort of trying to take a big ocean of wine and sort of trying to find the differentiations between these different wines? Because that does not apply to Friuli, obviously.
No, Friuli, yeah, it does not apply to it. Because we've been focusing on the incredible diversity that Friuli offers is what we want to focus on. We don't want it all to be, you know, one varietal. We want it to be a diversity. We want it to be this incredible mix and match. And then also when you mix it in from the different areas. And then, you know, we haven't even talked about Burda, right? So we're, right, you know, exactly. Then you've got Slovenia out to the east. Well, you know, the vines aren't, you know, they don't speak Slovenian versus Italian. And these regions, you know, they cross borders. And so you've got this incredible expansion of area. And then you have the different ways that the farmers on both sides of the border are working to express what in many cases, it's a relatively similar, you know, it's the morphology is the same. The same geology goes right across the border. And in a way, meaning the market, are missing out because the ones from Slovenia are, you know, many of them are absolutely extraordinary, but they don't have the same marketing, the same route to market that Italy has. And so we're missing out on what is essentially, you know, a much larger region. And could be broken down as you break things down geographically and add to the mix. We need more ambassadors. We need more people traveling and teaching, talking. And at the same time, we need the ozone layer. Who the hell are we to be out here flying all over, you know, the place?
Exactly.
They don't sell a Chevrolet or anything by introducing you to the vehicle and traveling all over the country and saying, would you like to sit in this thing? No.
Right.
You know, the amount of work that we do, the amount of money that we spend, we can talk about vineyards, we can talk about environment, we can talk about global weather changes.
Okay.
But, you know, at the same time, we are contributing to it because we need to do the proselytizing. We need to do the education. We need to physically be in the marketplace.
Okay.
Right, you still work the street.
Are you, when you say we, do you mean we as Dalla Terra or we as producers in Friuli?
We as producers in Friuli.
Okay. So that presence in the marketplace is still really important.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. Meeting the producer, going around, you know, shaking hands, putting bottles in sommelier's hands, that type of stuff is still important.
Yeah, we need to capture hearts and minds. And before you can put them in the sommelier's hands, you know, a few will beat a path to your door over there, but most will not. Most cannot. Most are unable. And so we need to come to them. And, you know, humbly, kindly introducing is, you know, here's a possibility, here's something, and here's why we believe that these wines deserve to remain on the international stage.
Gotcha.
This is why these wines have this type of concentration. And when you think about, I mean, Friuli is primarily known as a white wine region in the world.
Yeah.
And, but some of the reds that come out of there are incredible. And at the same time, Italy, when we're thinking about, you know, white wines, there's other varietals Vermentino, you know.
These are
varietals that really go the distance and are tremendously wonderful. You know, you think about the Loire and other regions that folks are familiar with. Those go the distance, right?
Yeah.
Those can go 20, 30 years. And some of these Italian white varietals can absolutely do the same thing, but it's a matter of getting them out, getting the SOMs interested, and making some of these wines available.
So what's really hot now for you? For you, is you deal exclusively with Italian wines. What is like the easiest thing for you to sell?
First of all, I mean, honestly, nothing today is easy. Really,
okay.
Nothing is easy.
I'll take your word for that for sure.
But when you look at the pie, the majority of the pie is, Pinot Grigio. That's what drives the Italian wine business.
Okay.
So that's what drives it. But what keeps us excited, what keeps us enthused and on track at Dolateran for people that are working with Italian wines in general. And again, I wish there were more. I mean, this is not about pushing competition out. I think the more the merrier. And let's build a bigger tent and get more people inside of this tent. And the tent is about diversity. The tent is about having things that other people don't have. So we don't, we'll sell our fair share of classic varietals. But a lot of what we're doing, whether it's mostly exploration of the different areas, hot areas are diverse areas. Things that people are interested in now are different, or it's a different viewpoint, a different way of slicing and dicing it. So let's take Mount Etna. Let's take a big volcano, that's a lot closer to North Africa than it is to Rome, right?
Yep.
Let's take Norella Muscolese grape. And most of you have never heard of Norella Muscolese, and Etna being grown up on a volcano in Sicily, deep in the heart of the Mediterranean. And yet these wines are often harvested around November 1st, you think Africa's right there. And so it's these stories, it's the expression of what we're finding in these different areas. You can talk about the evolution of Nebbiolo, and as Nebbiolo kind of arcs across from Barbaresco to Barolo up through Gemme, and then it gets up into the Alps.
Right.
And these Alpine, Yeah, I mean, Valtellina, exactly. And so we just began working a couple of years ago with a wonderful producer up there. And it's another expression of what originated as Nebbiolo. And it's the way of kind of diving and looking. And we can do the same thing with different expressions of Sangiovese.
So you mentioned Etna, right? Etna right now is like super sexy. And I love Etna wines.
We work with Tosca.
Oh, okay.
And their property that's on Etna is called Tascante.
Okay.
So we're with those, but it's the opposite of when we started our conversation in the 80s in Italy and making these big, powerful, Cabernet influenced wines. And you look at something like Norella Muscolese, it's delicate, it's soft, it's lighter in color. These are really elegant wines. And so that's just not a region that's changed. That's the entire palette, I would say, of consumers.
Okay.
That change. It's looking different.
Yeah. So if Etna is sexy, right? Let's say Etna is sexy, because for me, from what I understand, people are even people in Friuli talk about wines from Etna. How do we translate that same sexiness into Friulian wines? How do we do that?
First of all, it's benefiting from a little ADD, or in my case, ADHD. In other words, people have a short attention span. They want to try something new. What's new? What can we try? And then you tie it together with an incredible story and a region, the geography. That's one thing. The other thing is going back to the tip of the spear and keeping it pointy is that we're dealing with one varietal for the most part in Etna. So it's something people can get their arms around.
Gotcha.
And we're dealing with a volcano, 360 degrees, different elevations, different altitudes. So we're cutting that apart like the spots on a leopard and looking at what different producers are doing. So it's a combination of, human interaction together with what's naturally occurring at that part of, on the slopes of that volcano. But you're dealing it through the optics of a single varietal.
Gotcha.
And in Friuli, you ink. We're never going to get that amount of focus and direction.
No.
In Friuli, and that's okay. Friuli will always be will always be a conundrum. It will always be a question mark. It will always be not just the interpretation of the grower, whether you're looking at, you know, something as extreme as Vini Maturati versus, or, you know, Ramato or whatever versus other types of, you know, more traditional winemaking, but the varietals themselves and the region themselves. And so we need to accept it, understand it, and really embrace that as opposed to try and dumb it down.
Should we steal Austin's phrase and we should say like something like keep freely weird?
Oh, I love that. Kind of like that, right?
Right. Just keep freely weird.
I like that. I like that for all that it says. It's like, you know, being weird is a good thing. Being different is okay. Having these esoteric varietals, and they're always going to gravitate toward either consumer, the importer, and or the restaurant struts retailer that is going to really, that's going to embrace this, because it's going to see the beauty in all of this.
Right.
And I think people get tired of drinking the same damn thing over and over, people that are curious. And it's a little bit of our producer's Inami says, you know, it's a little bit of luxury in every glass. You can sink down into this stuff, and in the glass of wine, you can travel, and you do travel.
Okay.
To that part of the world and to the history of that varietal and to that interpretation of that vintage. And it may not be the best marketing recipe in the world to try and, like that movie, Everything, All at Once.
Oh, okay. Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. Yeah.
There's a lot of that going on in a region as diverse as Friuli. And as we say in Italian, guai se fosse diverso, no?
Exactly.
It'd be horrible if it's any different than that, because you're going from the ocean and a place like Grado that has these incredible, you know, historical, you know, Roman ruins all the way up to Cortina and the Alps and the foothills and everything in between. And it's really one of the most diverse growing areas in the world when you look at that, right?
For sure.
So, of course, we've got a whole bunch of different varietals that have developed over time, rightfully so.
Right.
And I wouldn't want to see it any different. And we continue to offer and encourage and support and be the cheerleaders for the families that stick by.
Gotcha.
By this, and for the folks on the other side of the ocean, in this case, they're willing to invest and build and grow with the idea of making our world, our everyday quotidian days, that much more interesting and delicious. Va bene.
Va bene.
Basta così.
Basta così. You've had enough. No, but I didn't want to finish up without, you know, sort of talking about like your historical client here in Friuli. I mean, you deal exclusively with, you know, your one sort of source here in Friuli, and you know, it's a great historical winery. And, you know, I just wanted to talk a little bit about sort of your history with them and what the things that they've done right, in your opinion. Because obviously, you've been working with Marco Feluga and with Rusi Cipriore for how many years?
34 years.
Wow.
I started out there in 1990. Marco Feluga was one of the very first people, along with Alois Legater and Alberto Di Grisi from Marchese Di Grisi. You know, they were kind of the initial folks that signed on.
Okay.
When I switched from winemaking full-time to building Dolaterra. And we've been with the Feluga family since then. I met them initially through Maurizio Zanella at Caldo Bosco. And it's gone through three generations. And so our job at Dolaterra is to remain relevant as we go through generational changes. And so originally it was Marco Feluga, who was at some point was the president of the consortium. And as I mentioned earlier,
yep,
I think helped drive some of the changes in the wine laws to allow for blends.
Yep.
To Roberto, his son, who passed away, unfortunately, a few years ago from cancer.
Yeah.
And now it's Roberto's daughter, Ilaria Feluga, that's taken the reins. And they've got the Marco Feluga Winery and the Rusi Cipriore Winery. Marco Feluga is a larger producer.
Right.
And they both have estate grown as well as long-term leases on vineyards. And Rusi Cipriore, which is estate grown and estate bottled. And they're two different approaches, basically around the town of Gorizia, just to pick a town that most people are familiar with.
Near San Floriano, right? They're very close to San Floriano.
Yeah. Well, Rizzitas is right near San Floriano. And for those listening, that is the border. San Floriano straddles basically the border with Slovenia up in the hills. So it's a beautiful, if you ever want to go cycling, I mean, that's one of my favorite places. I know Bobby's a big cyclist, but that's one of my favorite places to go riding is all around that area. And so it's an interesting, first of all, it's a multi-generational.
Yeah.
And second of all, they do work on kind of bridging the gap between when a lot of what we're talking about today is varietals and marketing and sales and introduction and education. And they do a wonderful job of bridging that gap between offering a wide variety of wines, as well as being true to the family style, as well as being true to the regional style.
Okay.
And they're very much proponents of freely, in this case, they're in Colio particularly, but you know, I think they're a wonderful ambassador as well for the region. And they've been a wonderful partner for Dalaterra and consistent, very, very consistent across the board in the U.S. with an emphasis always on quality and identity and reliability. These are all really important things. At the same time, you know, they've got experimental vineyards and they're trying different varietals and they're looking at all manner of kind of growth and expansion. I don't mean in terms of hectares. I mean expansion in terms of their mind, expansion in terms of their styles, expansion.
So is that, you think that's kind of the key to their success? I've always seen them more as sort of a very sort of reliable, steadfast kind of winery, right? They have the best of both worlds there, because Marco Feluga is the brand that you can sort of, you know, get your by the glass wines out there, and then Russi Cipriani is demonstrating the high level of quality that you can get. So you made a really good choice there.
Yeah, it's good because we really have two. Yeah, you know, we've got two different entities essentially, and now with the transition to Ilaria, and you know, she's around. I think she's a little less than 30 years old, so she's young, and is able to bring in a whole nother generation. And at the same time, it's looking at, you know, different ideas and bringing the winery into, you know, the modern times in terms of style, in terms of relationships, in terms of visibility, which is really important. So anyway, a wonderful producer that's now moved into their third generation. And we love where these guys are going. They've got a really, really beautiful, bright future. Fantastic. With Ilaria at the helm.
Yeah, I know Ilaria, and I think she might have even come to do a podcast one time. It would probably be towards the beginning when we were talking about Pinot Bianco. But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, having that new vision of Ilaria there as sort of the helm, I think there's only good things that are going to happen. And I think one of the things that I was thinking about when I was talking to you is, like, I think probably Marco Feluga's wine, the most important one, is actually a blend, right? The Molamata. That might be their most successful wine.
That's exactly when Marco was. Yeah, that's exactly what Marco's, you know, idea was. It came to fruition, came to reality, was the ability to do their, for each winery, be able to do their own blend.
Right.
And the Molamata is a great example of that. With Pinot Bianco, it's got Friulano, Ribolla, and I mean, these are just, they're it's a wonderful snapshot kind of what Friuli has to offer in their vineyards in particular.
Cool.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
But it's not easy to describe it. Do you want to buy the Molamata? I don't know. What is that? And then we got to tell the whole story. It's just another example of the beauty of what's in the glass versus the challenges that we all face in getting it out there and getting into the marketplace with proprietary names. It's very different than saying Robert Mondavi, Napa Valley, Cabernet Sauvignon. I mean, how easy is that versus, I've got this wine. It's a blend of these grapes you've never heard of from really with a name that, you know, that they invented. That's, you know, it's just, it comes with its own set of challenges. And that's, you know, those aren't going to go away. We're not going to ignore them. We're not going to back down from them. It's just, part of the game. It's part of what it is. And the only thing I think harder than what we're doing is trying to do it without vowels. Yozo are trying to do it without Burda.
Exactly. Trying to do without vowels. man.
Doing a similar area, similar
exactly.
Geology, similar.
And no vowels.
Saturn's right over the corner next door, but so I'll just count my lucky stars and be happy with what we got.
Cool. Brian, you keep out there fighting a good fight, pounding the pavement, singing the praises of Friuli and Italy in general. And I really appreciate you spending so much time here with me today.
Even thanks for the invitation.
No, the pleasure's all mine.
It's a pleasure. And when we circle back over all these various decades that we've been friends and colleagues, it's a treat to look back and check both of our paths, and especially when they overlap.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, you know, when you're hearing Friuli, always reach out. I know you have a couple of times, and we've been, you know, unfortunate with timing, and I've been out of the area. You've been in the area. You've been out of the area. So, yeah. But next time, let's try and sit down and have a glass of wine together.
Absolutamente.
All right, man. Maybe I'll see you in Verona.
Un abbraccio.
Un grandissimo abbraccio, amico mio.
Okay. A dopo.
A dopo. Ciao, Brian. Thanks.
Cheers. Ciao, ciao. We'll be right back.